Welcome to the second part of our podcast, How to Find a Win in the Data and Fill in the Gaps. We pick up the conversation with Matt Queen, U.S. Claims Vendor Manager at one of the country's largest leading specialist insurers.
On the call are, let's say, a handful or a good group of adjusters. And those adjusters have been stuck with the same software for their whole career, 20 plus years. Okay, and it's actually getting worse, they'll tell you. Or let's say, so they're, you know, they have, their options are to move up, really, right? Their options are to move up within the organization or do something completely different. So think about that person, Mary, at the insurance company and the litigation adjustment. Now, what does she do with that info? And then I also want you to think about the attorneys. So forget about the chief claims officer or the VPs of claims. They're, most of them, there's going to be some exceptions. Most of them are far removed from understanding her plight as the adjuster actually dealing with these systems trying to do this analysis. So it's, they don't even know where they're at right now. Mary knows as a litigation adjuster. But let's say you're Bobby, the junior defense lawyer, and you're in agreement with Matt as well. And you have two options. You can either try to get the ivory tower defense lawyer rainmaker partner to do something different, which he has no incentive, he or she has no incentive to do, just like the chief claims officer has no incentive to do. Or as you see, a lot of times they just wind up going to the plaintiff side because the plaintiff side does do more financial evaluation. So what if you're those people 5, 10, 15 years into the profession and you agree with everything? They agree with everything you just said. And they're like, okay, great. What do I do with this information? So you're someone that's actually taken experience and then moved it into new things. And you're, you know, just your book's really just getting started. Imagine what it'll be like 5, 10, 15 years, what you'll actually get done with this information, what could be done. But what advice do you have for these folks that are, you know, do they need to speak up more? I mean, well, yeah, should they be heard or should they just stay quiet and let things be the way, or are they actually contributing to it because they're on the front lines and they're not making enough of the stink? I mean, what advice do you have for those folks career-wise and solving the problem-wise?
It is never the front line's fault what's going on behind the scenes. So, you know, I think the people who are struggling in their career where they see the problems that I'm talking about, they need to be kind enough to themselves that, you know, it's not their fault that they're with an organization that doesn't share the problem. And quite frankly, the organization may see it too, but, you know, if your biggest problem, so, you know, if you're a carrier and your claims system sucks, but, you know, you can't figure out how to pay, you know, your vendors, obviously, you know, you need to figure out how to pay the vendors. And that's a stupid problem, but those problems do exist.
Sure, sure.
So leadership may just have a different priority at the moment. So what do you do? To go back to the question, well, here's what I would do. If I thought that I was smart enough to be able to do it on my own, first thing I would do is get to know, you know, basically the insurance Twitter crowd is a pretty solid little area. I think there's nothing like it on LinkedIn. I've looked all over Reddit for something similar, and it just isn't there. And Twitter's insurance sphere is pretty good. There's a handful of people in there who we could list, and you know, Nick Lamprell is probably at the top by starting that insurance nerds thing. There's also Rob Galbraith and a bunch of guys, you know, Light Townsend is another, who view insurance risk first. And it really doesn't matter what you do at that point. I mean, you and I could underwrite if you really wanted to, so long as you have the mindset of risk first. So then what do you do? So you meet these people, and then what are you looking for? Pivot into an area that makes sense for you and try to get into something new. It is the heyday for insurtechs and programs. So if you know what you're doing with a risk, I mean, frankly, if I were hiring someone for a role in a program or an MGA or an MGU, I wouldn't be too concerned if you have no background in underwriting, if you know the risk. So if you've been in claims for something and you get those claims, tell me what's going wrong. What have you seen? How do these policies play out in the free market? And then look for people who are looking for novel ways of insuring things. So the captive world is one novel form of risk financing. All it is just self-insuring a layer of the risk. Generally speaking, you have excess of loss insurance attaching at a certain point, or you have a quota share reinsurance treaty. Not that complicated. you just get a big tax deduction for self-insuring. And at the end of the day, it may even look like commercial. Yes, what's up?
So for the audience, I probably should have done this a little bit earlier, but like you might be a Fortune 500 company, you might have a couple hundred work comp claims, you might have a few other types of claims, and it's more profitable for you to be your own insurance company, more or less. And there's you've written a whole book on this, by the way. But then there's some insurance company that gives you coverage above that. I'm oversimplifying this. And you're the captive, and then you have this excess insurance that covers if something really goes wrong, but it's not covering the 80-20 of your claims. So if you're one of these people that you're talking to, that's a place where you get to have a direct impact on the bottom line of that company.
Exactly. And so captives are just one form of risk financing, which I think, you know, if you're listening to this and going, yeah, I mean, these guys get the risk, the world of captives may be for you. Join up with a captive manager, start your own management firm. There's a pretty good market right now for captives. But that's not the only place. Programs are another spot. So if you understand that, so right now, I'll tell you an opportunity in the marketplace. Property insurance right now is upside down. It's terrible. If you go anywhere from Montana south to Texas, property insurance rates or property insurance policies deductibles are so high that for commercial policies, they may not even cover the cost of replacing a roof. And the reason for that is because of hail. Hail is extraordinarily expensive. So what they've created are these parametric solutions. And a parametric insurance policy abrogates the concept of indemnification in favor of a predetermined payout. So they have these sensors that they'll place on property, and it'll sense when the hail comes, if it's a certain size. And if it's between X and Y, you get a payment of Z. If it's between A and B, you get a payment of C. In other words, if it's big enough, you get a little bit more money, but that doesn't necessarily indemnify you for the full cost of replacing the roof. All it is a super cheap insurance policy that gives you a specific amount of money based off of the occurrence of an event. Now combine that with a commercial policy or a captive solution, and you got yourself a brand new program. Then what you do is you take that bright idea, you know, you probably want to work with an actuary, get the numbers right, get the policy correct. Then you bring that to somebody with the money. Now the money is going to be Hiscox, it's going to be AIG, it's going to be Chubb, it's going to be some carrier, and then you pitch them on a program. Go do it yourself. Go take out, I mean, if you see opportunities in the marketplace, if you see there's problems out there, just, I mean, honestly, I mean, you did the same thing with your firm. You looked at the defense firms, you saw that they know how to win. You look at the insurance carriers, they don't know what the hell they're doing. You filled that gap. And you have a nice little company that sits there and says, look, there's an opportunity here for us to provide value. So for these people out there who see the problems with the carriers, you know, so my carrier, you know, let's pretend I'm working for AIG. They're no good for the you know, car dealerships in Texas because, you know, these property policies are no good. Go talk to the parametric boys. There's NEMA meters that you can go find. Go get yourself some reserves, which will probably be through a front or some sort of a reinsurance carrier. Shoot, man, there is captive risk pools out there with up to $100 million of assets. They're just looking to deploy. You go talk to them, sit there and say, look, we're going to get some POS ISO policy. I want your money. I'll put $50,000 of my own, well, I'll probably put more money in that. Let's pretend I raise, you know, $500,000 to put into it of my own cash. All of a sudden, you have a program overnight. You can do it. That's the entrepreneurial flank of insurance. That's how you keep the carriers honest at the end of the day. And it's not just the captives doing it. And it's not just the parametric boys doing it. As we increasingly navigate our way through this hard market, you're going to find additional programs popping up that take advantages of, opportunities in the marketplace. Again, going back to my stomping ground, skilled nursing. There should be telematics in place that demonstrate that nurses and LPNs are actually visiting these rooms and doing the flips, such that when a plaintiff's attorney comes around and says that stage four pressure ulcer is because you were not doing your job, you now have some evidence in the blockchain showing that, hey, no, we were there once every 4 hours and we actually just inherited someone with a problem from a hospital. So that flips the script. And that's the kind of stuff that you can say. You can sell the telematics, you can sell an insurance policy that requires the usage of that. Then you go use the capacity for someone else. So what I'm really trying to say here is you don't need to have $1 billion to start your own insurance company. All right. You can basically rent the capital from some other carrier, get it up and running, and then leverage any sort of insurance idea out there. But to get in this world in the first place, you do need to spend a little bit of time, like I said, in that Twitter sphere of looking at the people who are doing the cool stuff, parametric insurance, market index-based insurance. There's other another thing you need to understand is, I guess I'm kind of jumping on the concept of a trigger. So you've got claims made, you've got occurrence, they have other things out there. So parametric is a different type of trigger for indemnification. So what about an index? They have them out there right now, PhD papers talking about how they're linking insurance policies to indices. So this is really popular in crop insurance where they'll sit there and have, you know, like the whole nation of Sudan will have a crop failure because of drought. So then you have a policy that pays out all the farmers instantaneously as soon as that index is created. Other indices exist that we haven't measured yet. And then you can sit there and link that to some sort of an insuring agreement and boom, you just have a brand new insurance product. So what would some of those indices be? Literally whatever you want. There's systemic risks all over the place. You know, when bank failures occur, that creates a chain of events that leads down to reinsurers. That's the kind of thing that if you can model it out, you can put a risk number on it with an actuary, then you go get yourself some capacity and insure that sucker. Create your own form. That's a brand new type of insurance. And it could be for literally anything. Create an index for dentists. You know, whenever we have, you know, too many dentists using this crappy tool where we can basically guarantee there's going to be an uptick in the number of some type of incident. Maybe that's a bad example, but there's others out there. There's a shortage of semiconductors right now. So supply chain risks are a legitimate problem. In fact, you know, with the way COVID is and the fact that we are heavily reliant on places like China, that may be an opportunity right there. Start to suss out the network stream of, you know, if this breaks down, what are the logical places that we can ensure create opportunities for that?
We talked about advice, but we talked about at a high level, litigation's here to stay. I didn't, you know, with all the innovation I heard us talking about, none of it was around, we're going to be able to avoid litigation altogether. And then you started talking about, okay, if you aren't satisfied with the status quo, but you do have this budding expertise in claims, underwriting, insurance, litigation, you are in a perfect position to start ingesting this content, which you've done over the course of several years, and you can convert from handling a few cases to understanding some of the larger things at play in the industry, and then you being able to pick from probably blows your mind. It probably causes you as much frustration as it does excitement, all the opportunities that are out there. So I think that that's really good advice. I agree on following up with the Insurance Nerds Twitter, Nick Lamparelli. I try to tweet some of those things at Case Glide News, and I know you do as well. So tying that all together, okay, we are looking at what sounds like if you could come to this realization from 7 years in a profession and ingesting all the content that's available, which there is a lot of good content out there on insurance and innovation, and it's actually very tactical. A lot of it's getting very tactical as they start examining the hundreds of millions of dollars getting pumped into insurtech every month. So with that being said, what is the biggest change, if any, 5 or 10 years from now in the industry? Now, I know I kind of talked about this at the beginning, but I want to kind of come back together. I almost feel like you've convinced me of that there is this very strong feedback loop going on, and people are learning a lot more about different niche markets in the industry. So do you think that in 5 or 10 years, and we also talked about, by the way, how the current status quo in technology in the insurance industry. Do these employers, claims departments, and clients from an insurance defense attorney standpoint, do they look the same? Do they look completely different? Do they look more like the innovators you're talking about? And again, maybe you don't care because if you're in a attorney, you're getting litigation either way, but maybe you should, because your clients now will not be your clients in 5 or 10 years. I mean, what do you think happens in 5 or 10 years, given the ability to ingest this expertise and become an expert on this thing and then deploy hundreds of millions in capital, which we're seeing every month for the past 9 months into InsurTech? Have you convinced yourself that in 5 or 10 years it'll be completely different?
No, I don't think litigation is going to change. I think that the law is, generally speaking, good. It grinds slowly, but pretty finely. I'm not necessarily quite so bullish on criminal law. I think that that area could use some reform. But I generally support the American civil practice system, which is probably puts me in the extreme minority of people in insurance. I would expect that there's going to be a shift toward data. I think that, you know, we may be able to know when to hold them and when we fold them a little bit better. Eventually, someone's going to crack how to value a case, and that person's going to be super, super rich. But, you know, once you crack how to value a case, there's going to be adjustments made on the plaintiff side of things. So it's a constant, you know, battle back and forth. It needs to be done. That's for sure. We should not be trying the wrong cases. And, you know, ideally speaking, we should be managing risk better. But I don't see the fundamentals of litigation changing anytime soon. What I do see changing in probably a 10-year timeframe is that we will see the rise of the risk coin. I don't foresee US dollars remaining the best way of transferring risk. I'm not bullish on the yuan either. So the way I think about this is, you know, the dominant sport at the beginning of the 20th century was not boxing or baseball, it was polo. Polo went away, boxing filled its void, then baseball, eventually football became number one. And then after football, it's going to be, that's right, nothing. We're entering into a multipolar world because the medium is the message, and the medium is no longer television. The medium is no longer television, and the concept of a superpower is antithetical to everything that you and I live through. So you and I are analog children, but we're definitely digital adults. And now we have digital children. And the concept of some sort of a message, a unilateral message, is just never going to happen. Your kids are going to pay for food with currency A and pay for risk with currency B. All right? So the United States dollar may remain the world's reserve currency for an indefinite period of time, because the yuan, like I said, the Chinese government lies, and there's any number of reasons they need to have transparency in the world of finance. So the boys in London and New York are not going to jump on board the yuan. Consequently, unless the pound gets or the euro steps up, we're stuck with the dollar for some time. Although the relative power of the dollar is going to probably come down as China continues to ascend and the world realigns itself, which is nothing more than just the world following technology. The internet has created a federated mindset. I can't even tell you what the truth is. Between Fox, CNN, and Twitter, I've got three different realities that I live in at any given time. Consequently, I decline to believe that we're going to be continuing to finance risk through dollars and yuan and pounds. There's going to be a risk coin. And what's cool about the risk coin is that this gives us an opportunity to create an ecosystem just about risk. And where this is going to take us is, you know, if you have 10 risk coins can finance the risk for a Category 5 hurricane, all of a sudden you've got a highly liquid product or a token that can sit there and essentially function like an insurance-linked security, but also as a currency. And maybe only takes half a risk coin to finance your GL for you know, a whole bunch of, you know, Target stores across the U.S. And I know the actuaries and the underwriters in the audience are going to be pulling their hair out, but remember, all money is green. So the risk coins don't need to be underwritten to any particular risk. It is merely a medium of exchange focusing on risk. And we know that this is going to be somewhat prevalent because Bitcoin is increasingly adopted. It's in the reserves for Tesla. It is not unreasonable to think that insurance companies will soon be adopting Bitcoin into their reserves themselves. So alternative currencies are here, they're here to stay. The risk coin is coming, and I think it's gonna change the world. Risk, and this is my thesis, it's a little woo, but I genuinely believe that we just don't understand what risk is, but the risk coin will create an opportunity for us to measure something we've never really understood before. if the relative value of a risk coin is that it's going up, all the risks linked to that coin are being well managed, or we believe that they're being well managed. But if the relative value of the risk coin goes down, maybe that's because there's literally a Category 5 hurricane in the Atlantic Basin. So you'll have this extreme liquidity volatility that will be directly linked to risk that are going on. To the extent that we know the risks, the value of the coin should be changing. And this will create the most efficient medium of exchange in terms of risk. People will want to have risk coins because if these things are well managed, it's good for everyone. Risk, at least in the insurance sense, we don't like risk of loss. People die. People lose a lot of money, but more importantly, people die. So if we have another incentive to accurately manage risk, and we start trading our insurance policies based off of these risk coins, and we hold those risk coins as reserves in our insurance company, the fewer the claims we have as a planet, the greater the aggregate value of these tokens. And that's a direction that, you know, that Bitcoin has opened up and will radically change the way that we view the concept of what we're doing in this industry.
Wow. Did not see that one coming. So where should the investors send their checks to, Matt?
I'll have to start.
I love it.
I'm already thinking about Lit. I'm thinking about Litcoin. I'm like, well, if he's going to sell the risk, I'm going to sell the litigation. Okay, here we go. So we're on to something, right? I love it. And Litcoin, I can see the logo already. It's got the little fire emoji. I mean, we're on to something here. That was awesome. This is exactly why I had John. There's not a lot of people thinking big. I think there are on the Twitter sphere, like you said, but, you know, there's a lot of people that just don't have access to information. I am very fortunate, and I'm very glad that for whatever reason, people like you are willing to talk to me. And so I got a handful of those, and it's going to be good for the thousands of people that have been dedicating their lives to the 150, overloaded claim files that they have. So, I mean, you have to think big. By the way, you have just as good of a chance of being right as the experts do, as we all know, if not a little bit better on these type of things, because that's what's proven to happen is everything's moving so much faster than we think. And I think that makes a ton of sense. And I can imagine people all being able to invest whatever they want, fractional shares, and everybody having a little chunk of a little bit of risk and making their money and losing their money. I think the idea is that it's things like this are inevitable. That's what's happening with Bitcoin and it's what happened with Robinhood. I mean, where people can, there's a lot of money just sitting on the sidelines. So this is the kind of stuff, I'm so glad. I really appreciate you jumping on the podcast today. This is exactly the type of perspective we wanted. And like I said, we're going for home runs, not singles. That was an absolute home run. And I could talk to you for another 5 hours, which I probably will. But for purposes of the podcast, I just want to thank you. And we all owe you a debt of gratitude for sharing your insights. There's not a ton of folks that would do that. And where do you recommend people, reach out to you or find you or follow you or anything like that? Because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that want to try to play catch up to all those big ideas and big insights.
Yeah, I monitor my Twitter feed pretty well. I'm at BoneDaddy03. That is my, or you can find me as Matthew Queen on there. That is my AOL handle from when I was in the eighth grade, and I've kept it alive for all these years. So
a lot better than mine. It's a lot better than mine. That's awesome. So thank you on behalf of all the people listening to this podcast, Matt, and really appreciate it. You heard what the rich person idea is. Can you value a case at the beginning? I know what I'm going to do as soon as I get off of this call. So thank you for sharing your story with the Litigation Management Podcast. And I think you'll be back on again soon. But for the in the meantime, I really appreciate your time today, Matt. Thanks for joining the pod.
Thank you very much.